Welcome to the Solari Report. Today is Thursday, May 7th, 2009. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Tonight we're going to review the top stories in money and markets, address a few great questions from you, and ask Catherine. Instead of interviewing a mover and shaker, we have a special presentation, Derivatives 101, and then we'll be discussing briefly our movie, A Very British Coup. So money and markets. We just finished the first 100 days of the new administration. The 100-day mark has traditionally been a period when you stop and assess how the start of the new administration, how has everybody gotten off to a good start. And this 100 days has been a period that has been fantastically successful for the people who profiled, groomed, and backed President Obama. We've seen in 100 days the return to power of people who oversaw the $4 trillion missing from the Pentagon, and different agencies who helped engineer the bailouts during the Bush administration from the New York Fed and from Wall Street, and who made sure during the Clinton administration that the derivatives were not regulated and were part of many of the different financial frauds during the 90s. We've seen NAFTA recently affirmed with no questions asked. We've insured another $12 to $14 trillion, went into the large banks. That's partly in this administration, but partly after the primary, Obama throwing his political weight behind Bush and Paulson. That $12 to $14 trillion has gone with essentially no disclosure from the big banks about where the money's going. With that is a stimulus package of almost $1 trillion, which is being used for much greater controls top-down in communities throughout the country. We've seen affirmation of torture. Guantanamo Bay is still happening. And the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. There was a post today I put up about the $1 trillion annual defense budget. So the Pentagon is experiencing plenty of money despite the record deficits. We are watching this administration protect the Bush administration from prosecution, implementing a database that would facilitate a national ID, presiding over what I believe is a global biowarfare attack and related media campaign, and proposing significant capital controls globally, both in the name of curbing tax abuse and sort of economic warfare with the Swiss, which we're going to talk about a little bit sooner. But it's an astonishing record that shifts the country to significantly more centralized control, keeps us headed in the same direction we're going in the Bush administration. And what's astonishing is that despite the actual shifts with money and authorities, we see in reports steadily from minority and progressive communities that we need to give this president a chance. So I'm not sure what will be left after we finish him giving him a chance, but it's extraordinary to watch where we're seeing really productive opposition is coming from the middle of the country, the sort of formally Republican side. We talked last time about the Rasmussen poll, which I found to be unbelievably important, that said 60% of Americans say the government has too much power and money. That breaks down to 95% of Republicans, 75% of Democrats say the government has too much power, 2% of the political class think the government has too much power and money. And so if you just look at the split of Main Street versus political class, it's 85% against 2%, which is an extraordinary divide. And what we're seeing is a very interesting poll in the Wall Street Journal recently. It says GOP tries to dig out of its hole. And it shows what is remarkable, the loss that the Republicans are experiencing in membership is not going to the Democrats, it's going to independent. So it's going to be very interesting to see if we finally begin to see a breakaway from Main Street and Americans from the Republicans and Democrats, which are really just two sides of the pro-centralization team. So let's see how this evolves. Interestingly enough, Ron Paul, a very important sort of indicator of popular opinion, Ron Paul's H.R. 1207, which proposes auditing the Federal Reserve by the congressional auditor, when I last spoke to you in the last Solari report, had 70 sponsors. He's now up yesterday to 124. We talked last time about the extraordinary impairment of the rights of investors with the manipulation of the Bank of America purchase of Merrill Lynch, and we've seen subsequently Ken Lewis lose his chairmanship. He continues as CEO. Now we see a very similar kind of story with Goldman Sachs. You'll see the post on the blog, Questions, Questions. We watched a pattern that appears that the public disclosure of the bank stress test was delayed. Goldman raises a huge amount of capital during that period. Then the disclosure comes out after Goldman has done the deal. At the same time, we have Goldman Sachs hiring Barney Frank's staff. And we tremendous publicity this week over the former Goldman co-chairman with Bob Rubin, who was the Secretary of the Treasury, Steve Friedman, who has served as the chairman of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, and in that capacity received waivers that allowed him to buy, he requested waivers and in the meantime bought Goldman Sachs stock, which he's made about, at this point, paper profits, about $2 million for. It's an extraordinary conflict of interest. And we have the general counsel of the New York Fed in the paper trying to defend it. If this is not a conflict of interest, then there are no such things as a conflict of interest. Anyway, this afternoon we saw Friedman resign his position from the pressure. Also up on the blog is a story that I think a lot of people heard because of the television of an Air Force escort escorting supposedly one of the Air Force jets around New York City. The video was up on the Wall Street Journal site. And encircling, doing a flyby of the Goldman Sachs New Jersey business building, and you wonder what that's about. But with all the different news about Goldman Sachs, it was one of the weirder events. We talked last time about the Freddie Mac CFO found dead. The question, of course, in my mind was it really a suicide or was it something else? There was an article in the Wall Street Journal this week that essentially was designed to persuade the world that this was a suicide. This was a man who was very disturbed about the pressures on him and couldn't handle it. And it quotes the CEO of Freddie Mac, who's somebody I've done some research with. And it's basically a lot of quotes from him describing communications with the former CFO in one-on-one conversations that no one else could witness or corroborate. And I have to tell you, if I thought it was possible that it was not a suicide before, I just after reading that, I would say the chances are much greater. One of the most interesting stories over the last week and a half has been invisible capital controls. As you know, this is something that I expect and is of great concern to me. The treaty, the UBS litigation between the Department of Justice, the U.S. government, and the Swiss was resolved by Americans proposing and the Swiss accepting essentially a new treaty, which, if you look at the terms of it and how it's being applied, is essentially the Swiss caving on secrecy and inviting Americans to take their money and go unless they have a certain minimum amount, essentially accredited investors, it appears, and allow reporting by the Swiss to the U.S. authorities on a variety of different matters that would ensure that there was no privacy. So this is an extraordinary capital control because it means that Americans will not begin to enjoy the access to investment opportunities and liquidities that investors in Europe will. And it's just another step towards making sure that capital is channeled into things that Wall Street can control. In addition, the president has proposed new legislation to prevent tax havens and tax changes, including, it's really spun as tax changes for corporations. If you look at it, though, it puts on extraordinary additional capital controls. So what we're watching implemented in a very complex and very subtle way is a significant increase of capital controls. Now, the stock market was way down today, but it's been up, and you've watched tremendous descriptions of various commentators saying that this is a new rally and the difficult times in the stock market are over. I wanted to read you a piece from Abe Abelson's column in Barron's on April 27th, leading us to the question with which we began these musings. If those now infamous shoots of recovery are popping up all over, why would insiders be so aggressively dumping stocks? Yet they indisputably are. According to a study prepared by Bloomberg by Washington Service, a research outfit, directors, officers, and the like have sold $353 million worth of stock in this fading month, or 8.3 times the total bought. As a matter of fact, according to the firm, insider purchases of $42.5 million are on track to make April the skimpiest month for such buying since July 1992. Now, what that means is, as the market has gone up, insiders are getting out, which is why I continue to believe that what we're looking at is a bear trap rally, called a trap because as the market drops, it rallies for a short bit and traps people coming back in. On the other side, I would note that there is significant money amassing offshore. The president's approach is to pass laws to make it come back or to tax it. The reality is that the trillions are amassed to manipulate, and the minute they come back in, it could change the pH of the situation. Now, what we're going to watch in money markets over the next week is the long bond. We saw the Treasury auction not do well today, interest rates sneaking up. Now, this is very important because there are three variables that I watch all the time to see how the U.S. dollar is doing and the strength of the current system we're in. One is the long bond because much of the impact of the bubble burst has been softened by low interest rates. If we start to see interest rates sneak up, let alone get away from us and move into inflation kind of interest rates, then you're going to see a lot of money that needs to leave the long bond market fast. And, of course, the question is, where is it going to go? The second thing, of course, is the U.S. dollar, and the third is the price of gold, because if the U.S. dollar falls, it's possible it may not fall against other currencies. It's possible it will be part of all fiat currencies falling against real things, and, of course, gold is one of the bellwethers. So when you watch these three numbers, there's a war going on, and interest rates sneaking up means that war could get uglier, so it's worth watching. Okay, ask Catherine questions. We had a series. We have a series of great questions pending on precious metal, cash, and investment strategy, which I'm going to be talking with Franklin Sanders about next week during the precious metals update. There is, as we've seen, it looks like gold may be moving into a breakout. It's too early to tell, but it's certainly moved up. Silver's moved up a lot in the last week, and so the question for a lot of people with big cash positions who've moved out of the equity markets is, okay, what do I do? And we'll be talking about that. We've seen significant capital raising by some of the stocks that are either ETFs or reflect positions in precious metals, so it's clear investors are interested in increasing their positions. A lot to talk about next week. Okay, ask Catherine. One of the questions I got was, what is the correlation between the H1N1 flu, I presume that's the swine flu, and the U.S.-Mexico drug war? And the subtitle is, the surfacing of the influenza appeared at a somewhat advantageous time for the administrations of both the U.S. and Mexico. Is there a correlation between the ensuing drug war at the U.S.-Mexican border and the surfacing of this virus? That is a great question. The answer is, I don't know. But I suspect, because if you look at the way the flu was portrayed in the media, both sort of before, during, after the process, and you look at what was going on, it's very hard for me not to assume that it's either disinformation or biowarfare or a combination of the two. And, of course, the question is, what's the goal? Usually in situations like this, the goal are several, but there's no doubt about it that the drug war was heating up tremendously along the Mexican border, and as soon as this happened, we saw tremendous quietude, certainly of those headlines, and it is in a situation like this that governments get the ability to lock down a variety of things. So I suspect that there probably is a connection, because the importance of those cash flows to Wall Street and the global financial system are immense. So who knows what the truth is, but I suspect that whoever asked this question has a pretty good intuition that something's going on, and I agree with it. Second question was, please comment on Friedman's assertions about debt versus the net worth of the U.S. and also his population comments. Can world opinion alone keep the dollar up in a collapse? What that's referring to is a video that I posted on the blog, George Friedman, who's an analyst, talking about the fact that the U.S. economy is strong, the dollar is strong, and arguing that several factors will continue to hold up essentially the empire, one being the ability of this country to absorb significant amount of immigrants, which has always been very important to keep productivity rates up as the population ages. That's the one. The second is, he points out that our natural resources and net worth mean that we have a value of about 340 $40 trillion, which is very significant given our debt, and our debt is inconsequential when looked in the context of that number. And the third is the importance of the Navy and commanding the trade routes in the sea. If you kind of dig down underneath what he's saying, essentially he's making an argument for what I call the slow burn. There are a couple of good blog posts I've written about the slow burn, but essentially the importance of force to keeping up the dollar. Now, in a less polite way, what he's saying is it's possible to liquidate the middle class and replace the workforce with immigrants and do so in a way that continues to keep the country powerful and strong. And so literally what we can do is we can weaken or destroy certain populations within the country without in any way impairing the global power and force of the system as a whole. And my analysis in the slow burn is that is true. So I think it's worth taking a listen to, because the assertions he makes are important ones, and they're sort of part of the slow burn scenario. Derivatives 101. So for about a year now, I've been saying I need to do this, and so I finally was inspired to sit down and do it. What is a derivative? A derivative is typically defined as a financial instrument whose value derives from something else. So its value is derivative of something else. So it has no inherent value on its own. Its value, so it's total paper, its value reflects the real asset or financial asset that it relates to. So let me give you an example. An option on a stock, which is something many of us are familiar with. So let's say I have a share of IBM stock, and I have an option to buy or sell that stock. My option has no value. It's a man-made contract we invented. It's just a legal agreement, either between two people or through an exchange. And it has no value in and of itself. Its value is totally derived from the stock. Now, the stock's a piece of paper, too, but it has a value related to the assets of the company that's an interest in. So the stock has real value in that sense. But the option is simply an agreement about that stock, and so our value is derivative. Now, if you've ever felt frustrated trying to understand what derivatives are, you should join the club, because there are remarkably few people in this world who understand derivatives, which is astonishing when you think how important they are. Most of the derivative market has exploded over the last 10 to 15 years, going from relatively tiny and limited to enormous. And so to understand derivatives, to a certain extent, you need to understand the whole global financial system and all the industries in, if you're really going to have a complete understanding, because the derivatives... If there's a financial instrument to be had, then there's somebody's creating a derivative related to it. Now, I'm not an expert on derivatives whatsoever. When I worked on Wall Street, I worked with companies and with municipalities who were issuing bonds and stocks, and as a result, tried to use derivatives to protect their borrowing costs. What you'll see is the biggest market share of derivatives outstanding is interest rate swaps. And it started with companies or other issuers of bonds or who had bonds or other kinds of loans or IOUs trying to protect themselves from changes in interest rates. Or on the other side, investors who were trying to protect their investment returns and wanted to protect themselves from a drop in investment returns. So you had a variety of people who wanted to protect themselves from changes in interest rates. And so as I would work with companies or municipalities who would do derivatives to help them protect when they issued a bond, help them protect their or limit their borrowing costs. Now, when I left Wall Street and I went to Washington and worked at FHA, I oversaw as a regulator some of what's called the government-sponsored enterprises. That includes Fannie, Freddie. And then when I left, I went onto the board of Sallie Mae, which is the government-sponsored enterprise that helps securitize student loans. And Sallie Mae, like the other government-sponsored enterprises, was becoming during that period a huge issuer and user of derivatives to try and enhance their investment portfolio. Even though they were supposed to be a securitizer of student loans, they had very low rates because they were perceived to have a government guarantee. And what we saw start to happen during the 90s in anyone who was playing with what I call the federal credit, so the banks who had the federal deposit insurance, the government-sponsored enterprises who were considered to have an implicit guarantee of the U.S. government, what they would do is they would borrow money very cheaply in the short-term market and then loan it out in the long-term market and use derivatives to hedge or enhance their investment returns. So they were really just playing investment balance sheet gimmicks and turning their balance sheet into a way of printing profits, which they could do because they were playing with government credit. So taxpayers were financing these guys just simply printing profits using the taxpayer-funded credit. Anyway, so I'm sitting on the board of Sallie Mae, and there were seven vice chairmen of the biggest banks in the world, and we had the chief financial officer and one of his investment assistants who ran the derivative portfolio come in and give a presentation about derivatives. And I realized that no one on the board, I started to ask questions because I had been at FHA and sort of out of the derivative market, and so I had gotten behind and I was very interested. So I started to ask these questions, and what I realized was no one on the board understood a thing about derivatives, including seven bank vice chairmen. And I'll never forget saying, uh-oh. So if you feel, if you ever get frustrated about this, I assure you you're not alone. There are a lot of bankers who are also frustrated. The other thing to remember is, I'm not an expert, so my goal is not to try and teach you everything there is to know about derivatives, but to make sure you have a basic framework that will help you as a citizen and somebody responsible for your family or your business assets read the newspaper and understand how these things, what these things are and how they relate to you. And not from the point of view of being able to implement one or price one in the details, but instead I often say that you can look at a bridge and understand the concept of a bridge without having to be responsible to understand or be able to draw or implement the architectural specifications. So I want to paint a picture, and I want a picture where you can feel like you have conceptual mastery of what these things are. But again, I leave it to the experts to go into greater detail. And so if you're an expert listening to this and I grossly oversimplify, I hope you will forgive me because these are like, I often say these are like the joy of cooking. There are a lot of recipes. So if we're going to make it simple, we have to grossly simplify. Okay, so again, what is a derivative? It's a financial instrument that derives its value from something else. So in theory, think of every financial asset or real asset in the world. In theory, we could make a derivative out of, you name it, we could make a derivative out of it. So for an example, another way to describe it is it's a transaction or agreement that changes your relationship with an asset or cash flows in the future. So let's say I'm a farmer and I'm planting a cotton crop. And cotton prices are high now. I'm not going to harvest for another 2 or 3 months. I'm worried that the cotton prices are going to fall. At the current price, I can cover my costs and make a nice profit. So I enter into a derivative called a future. I enter into a future contract to lock in what my prices are going to be in the future. So another way to say it is derivatives are about time. They're about creating and anticipating and pricing the future. Another way to think about it is it's a way of creating insurance to protect against a variety of risks, whether it's a market risk or a price risk or a credit risk or a liquidity risk, without being subject to the laws and regulations related to insurance. Because one of the things, the reason we call it a credit default swap and not insurance or a guarantee is because we're trying to avoid that whole world of laws and issues. So, for example, if I'm a private investor and I'm willing to offer protection against weather problems, this is, weather is a whole other area for, or potential area for derivatives, So if I'm willing to offer that protection, I don't want to be in the property and casualty business and have to file with the state regulator. But I'm willing to just speculate on weather conditions, so I'm interested in writing a foreword or another kind of derivative interest instrument that will allow me to essentially guarantee or bet with somebody who wants to take the other side of that. Another way to think about this is it's a way to create parallel systems or field of influences that are invisible. It's, in theory, a way of owning and controlling something synthetically and doing it in a way that avoids compliance with all sorts of rules and costs that real ownership and control of the real thing entail. So, for example, I have funds offshore, and I want to invest in real estate in a country that limits foreign ownership. But a large financial institution, which is onshore in that country, is willing to buy that real estate, and in a series of swaps with me, I provide them with essentially the funding in exchange for the economic upside and income related to that ownership position. But I do it without having to move the funds abroad and without making related filings and disclosures. So essentially, I synthetically own the asset, but I don't really own it. So basic kinds of derivatives. There are four basic kinds of derivatives. There are forwards, futures, swaps, and options. And then a whole world of derivatives that are made with various combinations and flavors of those. So let me just walk through what they are. A forward is an agreement to buy something at a set price on a specified future date that is negotiated directly between two parties. And that means the terms and conditions can be subsidized. We can, you know, if you want to buy my orchid from me in 3 months, we can do a deal at a set price, you know, and price it out today. So I agree to buy a piece of real estate or a financial asset at a future date. I agree to buy precious metals a year from now or an agricultural commodity a year from now. I agree to buy euros or bonds or stocks next week, next month, next year. So I may not want the real thing, but I just want to get the value of it. So, for example, I can do a forward, and right before the forward closes out, I sell out my position with you. I don't have to take delivery of the real thing. I just get the economic benefit of what's happened to the price of that thing. Now, a future is a forward contract that's executed on an exchange. So it's standardized, which is makes it easier to track, disclose, and price, and is guaranteed against default. What that means is if you do a futures contract as an investor, then you're typically a buyer or seller. You're typically required to post capital, which is often referred to what you've got on margin. It's called on margin. So, for example, if a farmer wants to lock in the price of his cotton or wheat or other plant harvest, rather than waiting for harvest time, he can go to his broker who's trading on an exchange and lock in a forward contract that essentially hedges his risks if the price falls. Now, an option is the third kind. It grants the buyer the right to buy or sell something at a set price on or before a specified future date. So most of us know about an option to buy or sell a stock at a future date. It's called a put or a call. And, for example, if I'm an investor and I'm worried that a stock is going to fall, but for tax reasons I don't want to sell it right now, then I may write an option to protect myself. If the stock falls, then the option will make money, and that will offset my loss on the stock. A swap is an agreement to exchange future cash flows. So you have one kind of cash flow, I have another kind of cash flow, and we agree to swap either the cash flows or a portion of the risks related to the cash flow, or even just a portion of the cash flow. So there's several different, there's an infinite different kind of swaps, but the ones we're hearing the most about recently are credit default swaps. Credit default swap is essentially where I take the credit risk of a default on my transaction, and we've seen this with mortgage pools of mortgage securities. And essentially, I get you to guarantee it. So we've seen that this tremendously discussed in the headlines with AIG and Goldman Sachs. So when we bailed out AIG, AIG had written credit default swaps on a significant number of mortgage-backed securities. And when the bailout came out, $10 billion goes into Goldman Sachs because AIG was guaranteeing those through those credit default swaps. Interest rate swaps, the most significant, if you look at the statistics that report outstanding derivatives, what you'll see is that about 40 to 50% of total outstanding derivatives relate to interest rate swaps. So a lot of this are people trying to avoid risk if interest rates fall or interest rates rise, trying to get certainty in terms of interest rates. The disclosure that we've talked about with municipalities running into serious problems on derivatives, or municipalities entering into derivative deals to try and lock in, collar, or protect themselves from variable rate risk or other risk usually related to interest rates. And the structures didn't work, or there was tremendous pressure for a variety of reasons, or the insurance companies involved in either credit swaps or just guarantees have gone under, which has changed the structure as a practical matter for them, and the risks come back to eat the municipality. So interest rate swaps are a big piece of this. Then currency swaps, you'll see a big percentage are people trying to protect themselves from changing interest rates. So, for example, we have let's say we're the chief financial officer of a company with significant income in Japan, and we're concerned that the yen is going to fall against the dollar. And that's a problem because we want to make sure our reported earnings are stable. We want our reported earnings in dollars not to fall, which they will if the yen falls. So we arrange a currency swap or a series of currency swaps that locks in our yen-dollar exchange rates at those future dates when we're anticipating taking those incomes in. And it's not going to change our actual income, but the profit or loss on the swaps is going to offset declines, or we hope it's going to offset declines if we experience in the yen dollar ratio. So again, there are unbelievable combinations and concoctions of these things. One of the big issues on derivatives is, again, which I mentioned before, is are they traded what's called OTC, over the counter, or through an exchange? OTC means they're made between two parties just making an agreement, a bank and a corporation or municipality just entering into a contract. The advantage of that is it can be customized, so it can be designed for highly specific circumstances, and it's obviously more profitable for the financial institutions because they're making it up and it's not standardized. There's usually a chance for more fees, or there's less visibility about how much profit is on the table. The challenge with this is it's extremely difficult to price and value something. There's no market price for it the way there would be on an exchange. The valuation depends on a model created by the traders who invented or created the thing in the first place, often referred to in the derivative situation as quants. You'll see that used a lot. And it's extremely important or extremely challenging for internal accountants, internal auditors to understand. As financial institutions have customized and created and designed more and more of these things, they're very complicated, hard to track. And so running the accounting and the internal audit and the internal risk management can turn into a nightmare. And you get dueling models. And part of what you've seen in the discussion of the bailouts and how much money companies like AIG need to be bailed out is it's very hard for senior management to understand what the real risk issues are. And how to price these things. Of course, in this situation, when people stop trusting each other, what happens is the market freezes up and everybody just assumes they're going to price to worst case. And the worst case is very, very much lower than the best case. And when you have this kind of complexity and non-standardization, that's exactly the kind of thing that happens. Finally, the biggest problem, or one of the biggest problems with derivatives is that there is so much fraud in the system. What we've got, let's go back to our example of We have real assets in a company, or we use mortgage-backed securities. We have real mortgages that are in a mortgage pool, and we issue a mortgage-backed security with those real mortgages. And then we issue an interest rate swap on top of that mortgage-backed securities. And then as part of that interest rate swap, we issue another credit default swap to protect against credit risk, which makes it easier to price and trade the interest rate swap. So we have a series of derivatives on top of a securitized pool on top of a series of mortgages, which relate to a group. Let's just say we put them all in on 1,000 homes in one neighborhood, which is not really the way it gets structured, but let's just pretend for purpose of example. Well, what happens if everybody in that community loses their job and has no income and defaults on their mortgage? Well, what you can imagine is not only does the mortgage-backed security in trouble, but then the interest rate swap and the credit default swap are in trouble, and you have a real chain reaction, which is far worse than if you just had 1,000 mortgages that had lost value. Instead, you have a real reverberation that hits other people who are doing that credit default swap or interest rate swap for other reasons. And so the leverage that you've created with the derivatives now means if the situation goes down, there's greater pain. Now, that's in a situation where you've done a legitimate mortgage financing, you've issued legitimate mortgages, you've issued a legitimate mortgage-backed security, you've issued legitimate derivatives. What happens when, in fact, of those 1,000 mortgages, 200 of them were fraudulently issued? Either they were issued to people you knew could never pay them back, or we just used 200 mortgages that we'd also put in another pool. Well, now you've got a real nightmare because you've got this whole leveraged, highly profitable, complex financial engineering layered on top of essentially a pig in the poke. And so when you have fraud in the underlying asset or system, then you've got this huge upside-down pyramid sitting on top of something which is not real. And if you've read some of my stories about the mortgage market, then you know that I believe there's significant collateral fraud in the fundamental mortgages, and part of the problem we're dealing with on the bailouts is how you dig out of that because you've got such huge derivatives layered on top of it. Finally, one of the issues with the OTC derivatives is, and with the exchange as well, is that you have a real concentration of derivatives in the five largest banks. And their backers, again, we've had an explosion in the last 10 to 12 years. My numbers show we've increased at least 12 times, a multiple of 12 times in the total notational value of derivatives. And that whole world of players has tremendous power and force in terms of capital relative to everybody else. And I suspect, as we're going to talk about later, government backing for what they're doing or use of the federal credit for what they're doing. And certainly, as we've seen with the bailouts, the ability to put their losses back into government. So there's no regulation or enforcement to manage them, stop them, and what we're seeing them doing is functioning as predators, literally making money from attacking everything from companies to countries and trading on insider information. If you think trading on insider information is profitable, see what you can do when you can leverage it with derivatives. And it'll give you a little sense of why this explosion of derivatives really parallels the extraordinary centralization of wealth. Now, exchanges and trading derivatives on exchange force the standardization of underlying assets to serve financial interests. One of my concerns is if you look at the agricultural industry in the United States, we see government programs, a combination of government programs and standardization by exchanges, really forcing most farmers into a few different kinds of highly standardized crops. And that has a terrible ramifications for sort of the health of, it's probably one of the biggest issues in legitimate food safety concerns. And again, we have the concentration and intention of players. You would think that an exchange would give you greater powers to regulate and enforce. That hasn't been the case. One of the newsletter writers who's written a lot about the concentration of derivatives and their use, starting with the suppression of the gold price and the manipulation of the commodities markets, but also the wider manipulation of the economy and markets, is Rob Kirby, who's got a Kirby Analytics website, but you can pick up his writings. And if you're interested in that question, Kirby's somebody you want to follow. The Bank of International Settlements in Basel, Switzerland, is the central bank to the central banks, so it's the meta central bank globally. And they keep and publish statistics on derivatives, as do the associations, derivative associations, and the exchanges. So if you're interested in digging down more in the statistics, I recommend you take a look at those, but then go to Kirby to take a look at sort of the concentration of the U.S. banks, which is extraordinary. You literally have J.P. Morgan Chase, Citibank, Goldman Sachs, and a handful of others really having an enormous concentration of global positions in this area. So other players and who's who. The important thing to understand about derivatives is that everyone in this phone call, directly or indirectly, is a player in derivatives, because they are such an important part of the whole economy. The BIS statistics on OTC derivatives indicate that there are, let's see if I can get, $658 trillion of notational value. That translates into about $20 trillion of market value in terms of risk position. So we're watching a world where a derivative is getting created on most financial assets and literally creating a parallel market and valuation on most financial assets and issues around the world. So each one of us, directly or indirectly, is playing with derivatives. So whether you have, if you have mutual funds in your investments, those mutual funds are probably working with derivatives to protect themselves from interest rate changes or credit risks. If you're the beneficiary of a pension fund, your pension fund may be working with derivatives or putting money in funds that are. If you have insurance, your insurance company is probably using derivatives to hedge. We all eat food. Forwards and derivative contracts are being used to hedge and manage and keep the price of food down. So each one of us, there's tremendous pressure from American people to make sure that markets aren't volatile. And, for example, if you want to keep somebody out of investing in gold, just manipulate the price up and down and make sure it's really volatile. Works like a charm. A lot of us don't want the red button pushed. Derivatives are critical in helping the U.S. banking interests and U.S. government make sure everybody's vested on keeping the dollar up, because they're all part of derivative debt or derivative positions that make them. We've used these to create a constituency for a certain kind of future. So we've made it financially attractive for everybody to bet on the dollar remaining strong. They've either got a big position in dollars, they owe money in dollars, they're vested. Okay, so I'd like to talk a little bit about how we could use derivatives to improve liquidity and our financial position in communities. And part of the reason I want to do that is to help you understand what a derivative is and how it's used, but also because if you look at the usefulness of a derivative to protect people against risk or to reduce their risk, there's no reason that these techniques couldn't be used by ordinary people who are not financially sophisticated to improve or reduce our dependency on the large financial institutions and players. So two can play this game, and let's just talk about how we might do it. Okay, so next what I want to do is look at derivatives in the context of not big, sophisticated financial institutions and the bailout thereof, but in terms of how we could use these same kinds of contracts and agreements and techniques to improve our financial security and to create more liquidity for ourselves and our family and our community. So
So let's take a look at what I call community derivatives. If we were going to do derivatives in our community, what would it look like? So let's start with some examples. Many of you have heard me tell the story of the three women who are friends and are banking in a way to advantage the large bank. So let's walk through that example again. Let's say we have three women in a community in America named Beth, Sally, and Debbie. Beth has a 10% CD. She's earning 2.5%, which is the average median rate in Memphis, Tennessee, which is the area where I live. The national median rate is about 1.5%, but the Memphis median rate is about 2.5%. So Beth's earning 2.5% on her $10,000 CD, and she's doing that CD with a local bank, and their correspondent bank is a New York Fed member bank who is paying them, just for this example, we'll use 3%. Now, Beth is getting $250 a year, and the local bank is getting $50 a year. Now, Sally has $10,000 in stocks. She's hoping to earn 10% when the stock market comes back, and she's taking more risk than Beth, but she expects to get a bigger return. 10% is a lot more than 2.5%. If she does achieve her 10%, she will make $1,000 primarily in capital gains on her stock. She doesn't want to sell her stock because she does not want to make a capital gain and have to pay a tax. Debbie has started a business with her credit card. She financed her business with her credit card, and now her credit card company has raised her rates, particularly with the cutbacks in credit, so they've cut her credit, and she's now paying 25% on $10,000 that she borrowed to start her business, and she's paying $2,500 a year. That's 25% on $10,000. So Beth is making $250 on her $10,000, which she's essentially loaning to the banking system, and Debbie's borrowing it back for essentially $2,500. It's an enormous spread, or what we used to call on Wall Street arbitrage. Now, let's say when the CD matures, rather than reinvest at the lower CD rates, which are falling now, Beth agrees to loan Sally $10,000 at 10%, which means Sally can take the money and refinance out of her credit card where she's paying 25%. Beth does not feel she can afford to take the credit risk that Debbie might default, so she does a credit swap with Sally on Debbie's loan. And in exchange, she gives to Sally, she reallows to Sally, if you were, $500 of the interest she's going to make payable as she receives the interest from Debbie. Now, what that means is she's taken half of her 10% or 5% and given it to Sally in exchange for Sally's, in essence, guarantee of Debbie's credit. So if Debbie defaults, Sally will pay Beth the money Debbie owes. Meantime, it turns out Sally is using part-time landscaping services from Debbie currently and knows even in the worst case, if Debbie defaults, then she can get her money back from in-kind services as long as Debbie can work. Now, Beth is making 5% instead of 2.5%. So instead of making $250 a year, she's doubling that. She's making $500 a year. Sally has made another 5% on her $10,000. So her risk that she won't make her $1,000 goal is a lot less. She has more risk because she's now betting that Debbie can pay back, but she can get her funds back through in-kind services in the worst case as long as Debbie can continue to work. Debbie is paying 10% rather than 25%, or that's $1,000 instead of $2,500, which is an extraordinary difference to somebody in that circumstance. The New York Bank is at a gross profit of $2,200 that it was drawing out of the community by borrowing from Beth's bank and lending to Debbie. So that's an additional $2,200 that was being exported out of the community that now is circulating in the community. Now, if the community has a low multiplier of 1.5 times or a high multiplier of 4.5 times, that translates into a larger gross neighborhood product of about $3,000 to $9,000. What do I mean by multiplier? That's how many times dollars circulate in a community before leaving the community. So a dollar spent in a community will multiply into other economic activity in that community. And part of slowing down the money and circulating it in a community or in our networks is to increase the multiplier that advantages us and the people that we are trading with. A variation on this would be if we partner with a local bank or credit union so that they help us underwrite the credit, counsel the borrower if the borrower needs counseling, and help service the arrangement. They're in the business of servicing loans. We're not. And so it's a lot easier if we have someone, a good local bank or credit union that we trust doing that. So as a result of that, we take a portion of our profits or earnings on the deal, and Beth and Sally are making, and we put it into the bank for playing those functions. And that way, in fact, the local bank makes more money than they would if they were doing the deal with a big New York bank. So that's an example of how something like a credit default swap could work if we use those techniques in our community. So let's look at another example, and let's use an example of something more like a future or a forward. So we have a local farmer who uses natural methods and is concerned that corn prices are going to fall before he harvests. He is also short on funds after buying seeds and paying people to help him plant. So he could use some money now. At the current corn prices, he will cover his costs and a nice profit if the prices when he harvests are that high or higher. If prices fall, though, he's going to experience a squeeze on his margins or even a loss, and he can't afford that. So he doesn't want to take the risk of the impact of falling prices several months from now. Meantime, two of the farmer's customers for his corn want to help him. One, they enjoy the corn and his other produce and appreciate that his cash flow is thin. They're members of a local Solari circle that has an investment LLC that's focused on local investment. They believe the price of corn is going to rise over the harvest season and want to take a position. They can afford to take the risk, whereas the farmer can't. They don't want to invest in futures on the futures exchange because, in essence, that means they're investing in contracts on genetically modified corn, and they don't want to invest in that system. So instead, they enter into a private forward with the local farmer, and meantime, the local farmer has arranged crop insurance from a third party, so they're all covered if the crop is destroyed by weather conditions or drought. One condition, however, it turns out there's another member in the Solari circle who's interested in taking delivery on all or a portion of the corn. He's married to the owner of a grocery store, and they're concerned about locking up a significant supply because the demand for naturally grown local sweet corn has been rising significantly. So part of the deal is their networks can take delivery of the corn. Now, it turns out the corn price falls. The farmer's glad he did the contract, but the Solari circle loses money. However, they did team up with a local bank to buy the credit default swaps on refinancing a series of the local business people out of expensive credit card and consumer loans. And, interestingly enough, one of the local businesses' problems was they were paying very high equipment lease costs. The only people who would give them equipment financing were people who were trying to facilitate purchases of new and more expensive equipment. So in this instance, the Solari Circle has partnered up with a local bank, done some credit default swaps, facilitating equipment leases on equipment bought from a local appliance store that's particularly good at repairing appliances and office equipment. So on these series of credit default swaps, the Circle had a very good experience and made a fair amount of profit, and that helped offset their losses from the forward that they did with the farmer. So again, another example, you have lower expenses to the business in a community, you have higher investment profits in the community, and it's all by circulating things locally, and in the process it multiplies to a higher gross neighborhood product. So everybody knows the expression gross domestic product. Think of that downsized to a neighborhood, it translates into a higher gross neighborhood product. Third example, spinning off of the idea of currency swaps. Let's say there's a retired teacher who's moved from Canada to live next to her sister here in our community in America. Her pension benefits are in Canadian dollars, which means every month or every quarter or every year, she gets her pension benefits, but her expenses are in dollars. And as the Canadian dollar fluctuates against the U.S. dollar, she can have more money in dollars or less money in dollars. So meantime, we have outsourced a small portion of our printing business to a company that her brother still runs in Canada, you know, through her, we met him and ended up doing business with him. Now, she's worried, the teacher's worried, the retired teacher's worried that the Canadian dollar is going to fall next year versus the dollar, which will reduce her spendable income, and she wants to protect against that. Meantime, our business is concerned that the Canadian dollar will rise and our expenses will go up, and we want to lock in our costs now. So we agree to do a currency swap that allows both of us to hedge our risk for the next year. Now, the theoretical options of how we could create community derivatives are endless, but they're worth exploring. It's worth learning about derivatives, not just to understand the news and understand sort of the game that we're watching in Washington or the economic warfare around us or the dirty tricks or how companies legitimately hedge their risk or investors hedge against falling investment returns or improve their investment return. So there are many reasons to understand derivatives as they now exist. But one of the great uses of understanding derivatives is to think about how we could apply these tools and techniques to help us build up our own financial security, both in our family and our networks and our communities. Again, for those of you who are gathering into Solari circles, to begin to talk about our different financial needs and how we might help each other offset our risks over the future and through time. So most importantly, when I'm showing you examples of where people can build alignment in communities, because we've seen so many different examples of how derivatives and financial tools like this are throwing people out of alignment. In our example, if Debbie defaults, let's go back to the first example of the three women who are sharing, you know, who are financing each other. If Debbie defaults, then the community, Sally has a vested interest, and Beth as well, in helping Debbie succeed so she can pay back the money that she owes. So we're trying to use these tools to build alignment between different parties in a community in a way that people make more money by helping each other succeed. So if you look at it, the theoretical options of how we could use derivatives to create all sorts of risk management tools in a community are endless. And so it's worth thinking about, it's worth understanding how these different contracts and arrangements work and how we can use them to profitably increase liquidity locally and build alignments. Now, what that means is we're all going to have to start talking about money. And it's interesting, if you go to Wall Street in Washington and you live in that world, everybody talks openly about money within certain spheres and opportunistically looks for ways of doing these kinds of deals, you know, but we haven't started to do that among ourselves in communities, and that's part of what we need if we're going to transform the economy. Now, one of the things that's so important to understand about these kinds of situations is, in the community derivative examples I just gave you, we're trying to build alignment between different parties. One of the problems we've seen with the growth of securitization and derivatives is a whole series of ways of creating non-alignments. And so I want to talk a little bit about the dark side of derivatives and why we're literally seeing a situation where we're able to create a whole bunch of people, a constituency within a whole bunch of people for bad things happening to other people. Okay, dark side of derivatives. When you all have heard me use the expression financial coup d'etat, and derivatives are very much a part of a couple things. One is market management. There is a group called the President's Working Group on Capital Markets, which we have seen significantly move in with New York Fed member banks as their agents, taking positions that cause markets to behave in ways that do not reflect supply and demand. So, for example, the Gold Antitrust Action Committee, GATA, has written and spoken a lot about the suppression of the gold price and the use of derivatives to manipulate the gold price down. We've seen similar kinds of discussions and complaints about manipulations in the stock market, manipulations in the bond markets.
So what we're watching is private parties end up with gold or other assets. The banks end up with derivatives and the government bailing them out because literally you have managed markets and the derivatives that are used to manage those markets and literally rig prices and flows of capital are financed and supported by government, and we're the ones who are paying for it. So number one issue, dark side of derivatives, is this is allowing markets to be politically managed as opposed to reflect actual real supply and demand. And so as a feedback loop to society, we're losing our ability to tell what's up and right, what's down, because those prices are very important indicators. And so rather than the flow of capital reflecting performance or real supply and demand considerations, we're seeing it instead reflect who is politically anointed. Okay, issue number two, money laundering. I would suspect that that derivatives have played a very significant role in allowing offshore dirty money to essentially control from behind the scenes in very invisible ways. If you read my Dylan Reed story, I talk about firms like KKR, leverage buyout firms, being able to buy and take over companies, and who the real bondholders are, is invisible and allows people to control from behind the scenes. Well, derivatives make it even easier to control from behind the scenes than even those arrangements. So, again, let's say I want to buy a stock with offshore funds, but I don't want my name on the stock. I don't want anybody to know I own it. I simply arrange with another offshore hedge fund to buy the stock. They write an equity swap to me. I can enjoy the income, the losses, the gains associated with the stock. And if I have the kind of powerful enforcement and friends that I may have, then I have the ability to enforce my wishes and influence on the company from behind the scenes. I suspect what we saw in the 90s and to date is incredible power of offshore monies working invisibly through a variety of arrangements, one of which is derivatives. Another one, economic warfare. We watched options be used to take down Lehman Brothers. It's a perfect example of a group of private investors getting together with the help of the exchanges and the government and literally taking a firm down using derivatives to manipulate their stock price in fantastic ways. It's a great case study. We have a story on the blog of Morgan Stanley in Kazakhstan literally taking down a bank in a way that's incredibly harmful to the country. And a wonderful Financial Times article explains that literally that Morgan Stanley makes more money if they take down the bank. So again, we're watching this non-alignment happen between the financial banker to a country and the local bank and the country. Literally, their lead bank has become a predator, and they make more money on the country failing than from succeeding. Many of you heard our conversation with Dmitry Orlov, who talked about the rape of Russia. The crash of the ruble beforehand was instrumental to Russia failing. And if you look at all the different allegations behind that whole process, it appears that derivatives were very important to making that happen. Same with the Asian crisis. So we're literally, Warren Buffett called them the weapons financial mass destruction. We're literally looking at a financial tool that gives leverage to a variety of people, particularly when they're backed up by central banks and governments, to rape places. Another dark side to derivatives is covert events. We have a situation where if I have inside information that a covert event is going to happen, so an assassination or 9/11, that information gives me the ability to trade on inside information. If you look at some of the researchers who've looked at the financial patterns in and around 9/11, what we saw was allegations of different positions and options and bonds and currencies and sure enough derivatives. And again, derivatives simply gives you the ability to significantly leverage your positions, often in very invisible ways. So if you've read Naomi Klein's wonderful book, Disaster Capitalism, it gives you the ability to make more money and leverage off of disasters, particularly disasters that can be anticipated or disasters that can be made worse through a variety of mechanisms that can be combined with trading, including with derivatives. So, you know, trading on inside information just gets meaner and more profitable with the use of derivatives. Finally, again, inventing a future. You have the ability through derivatives to literally create a constituency for a certain kind of outcome. And one of the things that concerns me, I moved a post that we did called Paper versus Real Things up to the top of the blog tonight, and I would really encourage you to look at that chart. It shows the gentleman who made the chart, his estimate of both OTC and shadow derivatives. He says $1,600 trillion of total derivatives. That's at the top of the triangle that comes down to a picture of planet Earth with an annual gross global product, if you will, of $55 trillion a year. And it shows at the bottom of a triangle $2 to $4 trillion of gold and silver, the idea being that as all this paper ultimately needs a real place to go, there's only a tiny piece of earth and a tiny bit of gold and precious metals as an alternative currency. You get a feeling for the potential for non-alignments, particularly if a portion, or let alone a significant portion, of those derivatives are layered on top of things that don't have integrity in terms of their expression of the real world. So, for example, I use the discussion of collateral fraud. If we have a lot of credit default swaps that are outstanding in mortgage-backed pools that are in some way, shape, or form fraudulent, then we've got a real non-alignment. And if we're going to bring ourselves back into alignment, if we're going to find a way to align places and people and natural systems with how the financial system works, then this question of the abuse and misuse of derivatives is one that's going to have to be illuminated and understood. And so that's one of the reasons I commend you for understanding them. Now let me just, I used to call these hippos, which are risks on the horizon. Let me just mention a couple of hippos. One is, I said that the biggest outstanding amount of derivatives is in the interest rate area. We've watched interest rates fall and be relatively stable. One of the things I intuitively believe is that interest rate swaps have been critical to holding up the dollar and positioning the dollar worldwide. One of the questions is going to be, if interest rates rise dramatically, what is that going to do to the Treasury bond market? What is that going to do to the derivative positions? I think that's a big and important question. It's not one we're going to go into tonight, but I think it's one that needs to be on the table. Disaster capitalism. Derivatives create enormous financial incentives to ensure disasters happen in some ways, in some places. My bet is that a fortune was made on derivatives on the Mexican flu scare. We talked about whether or not there's a relationship between the Mexican flu scare and the war on drugs. I suspect there is, but with any event like this, there's tremendous trading. If you look at what could have been done with stocks and stock options, currency swaps against the Mexican pesos, with futures and forwards and all of that, it would be very interesting, but I suspect that a tremendous amount of money was made in the derivative markets on the flu scare. Weather modification. Cliff High, if you listen to that interview, talked about patents for weather modification. The possibilities of combining derivatives trading with weather modification and future expectations of weathers and agricultural derivatives are just, I don't even want to contemplate, but I think that's sort of a risk area to just keep in the parking lot. Finally, a prediction. The cap and trade and carbon offset system, my prediction is, if it goes into effect, and I hope it doesn't, but if it does, will turn out to be the single greatest area of derivative abuse to date, if it happens. So watch out and be careful. Much of this is being sold as great for the environment and great for natural systems. My prediction is it will turn out to be quite the opposite. So big risk area there, and a discussion for another time. Good sources. If you want to get a basic primer on derivatives, I would start with Wikipedia and just getting some good definitions. That's number one. Number two, a good sort of academic textbook introduction and presentation is Derivatives Demystified by Andrew Chisholm. And if you want to get the sort of entertaining, funny storyline, is a wonderful book called Traders, Guns, and Money. Not sure if I can pronounce his name. It's Satyat Das. And he was in the derivative markets for many years and then became a professional helping issuers, investors protect themselves from the people who made the derivative markets. But he really has a sense for the bubble and some of the uses and misuses of derivatives. And I recommend it to you. So that is it for Derivatives 101. And a great subject. And very much, if you want to understand the slow burn and where the dollar is going to go and what is sort of driving the financial system in our world, a great thing to understand. If you, in 1989, when I was Assistant Secretary of Housing and the housing bubble burst, the U.S. government ended up buying back a huge amount of mortgages and ended up in the property disposition business. It's not happening now because in the last housing bubble bust, we had tremendous mortgage issued, but derivatives were issued on top of it. This time around, the government is bailing out the derivatives, and the complete control of the mortgages are occurring from the parties who created the problem, and that leaves them in control and not the government. And that may be one of the reasons the government, with its TARP money and a variety of other policies, is trying to keep control of the bank, because the real paper, the real things, the real communities are being now controlled from the banks, who basically engineered the housing bubble. Okay, so let's talk about a very British coup. A very British coup was a movie made for British television about a candidate, winning candidate for Prime Minister, Harry Perkins, becomes Prime Minister on a platform of disarmament and proceeds to put together a cabinet and literally proceed with trying to implement disarmament, or nuclear disarmament. And he finds himself immediately up against an entrenched partnership of spies and diplomats and everyone else. The first thing, and all the dirty tricks, no, I shouldn't say all the dirty tricks because there's so many of them, but a whole portfolio of the dirty tricks that an honest government official who's trying to change policy runs into, because there's no doubt about it, Harry Perkins is trying to hit the red button. So what happens? The first thing is the intelligence agencies are listening to and recording his conversations. And, you know, what you'll often hear is people tell you that the Brits record the Americans and the Americans record the Brits, and then they swap intelligence so that they can avoid the laws related to not being able to record and listen to their own politicians. So the Americans are recording, and so their phone calls are being listened to. The first thing that happens is one of his most important cabinet members is having an extramarital affair. The affair gets outed in a context where he's forced to ask for the cabinet member's resignation, and then the man's wife commits suicide, and you've got a terrible mess. The next thing you know, he expects support from the unions, but the warfare interests are able to peel away one union and engineer a shutdown of sort of people's electricity. And so they try and turn the population against Harry, and then they try and smear him with sort of trying to create dirt in his past that doesn't really exist, and on and on and on. So you see all the different pressures on an honest person. We finally come down to a moment when Harry has to get on TV and win the population to his side he has managed to get on TV because he's led his staff around him to believe he's going to say what the powers that be want. And in fact, he gets on TV and says what he wants. And what you see is a very important moment when one person on the, I think it's the BBC, reaches to turn Harry off, and another one stops him and leaves him on. And you're left with the critical question is, will the media allow a prime minister or president to really tell the truth, or will they get blanked out? And it's an important question because my guess today is in most instances a president or a prime minister would get blanked out by the media. And I wanted you to watch it because you really, it does a wonderful job, even though it was made in 1989 and it's 20 years later, it does a wonderful job of letting you feel what it's like to be in that position and to literally be up against an invisible group of private interests who are just working and manipulating it. And it gives you a feel of what your political representatives are dealing with every day. So it gives you a feel about the game. What it doesn't address is the fact, doesn't address the red button issue. If a British prime minister really went forward with that kind of nuclear disarmament, they would probably be hitting the red button, and I suspect the British people, as well as, you know, just like the American people, don't want that red button hit. So it doesn't deeply get into the economic issues of the ramifications of what Harry is doing and the sort of global game around that. So that's it for this evening. As we close, let me just remind you, next week is the Precious Metal Update. We're going to be talking, responding to your questions about ETFs and cash. Where would you put cash and different questions in and around investment, including precious metals? The movie's going to be Point of No Return, which is a Bridget Fonda movie. It's a remake of a French movie, La Femme Nikita. And I want you to watch it, and next week when we discuss it, there's one scene towards the end, which is the only piece I'm going to discuss. So we're only going to focus on one little aspect of it, but it is an aspect which is very important for you to understand and I believe could be unbelievably useful to you over the next couple years as we sort of go through this period of transformation. So I would encourage you to watch it because I think it's going to be an important insight. And then on May 21st, a conversation about media with Alistair Thompson, publisher of Scoop Media, which is the leading online independent news in New Zealand with significant readership from the United States. I was talking with a subscriber recently, and they said they had asked a friend if they could ask me any question, what would it be? And the question was, how do you make sure you're getting the information you want and need in a timely manner? So that's what we're going to be talking about. How do you get the real deal from the media in a way that is entertaining and energizing for you? And not surprisingly, our movie is going to be Network, that incredible movie about TV news. So until next week, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Good night. And good luck.